You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, I'm Naomi First, and welcome to our first data special podcast of 2020. Today I'm joined by THE's data editor, Simon Baker.
Hi, how are you doing?
And we're going to discuss some of the biggest higher education data stories of the past month. Firstly, we'll take a look at whether in 2020, HE sectors across the world have finally recovered from the 2008 financial crash. Secondly, we'll be discussing new THE analysis on how the UK HE is becoming increasingly reliant on Chinese students' fee income. And finally, in Indonesia, could a government policy be fueling the production of low-quality research? For higher education, as well as many other sectors, the first part of the last decade was really dominated with reaction to and the attempted recovery from the 2008 financial crash. In an analysis from the 23rd of January edition of THE, Simon Baker used data from UNESCO to examine how various countries adapted their HE spending since the crash and what the resulting impact has been. So Simon, first of all, can you explain what data it is you're using for this analysis and how that works?
So UNESCO has like loads of very interesting data on education spending, on graduation, on enrolments, all sorts of things really. But anyway, for this I kind of looked at, they had some data on the amount that governments are spending per student on higher education in various countries. I mean, it's not always kind of complete in terms of a data set, but there's enough there to get some quite interesting findings. So you can look at the data just by sort of absolute sort of cash values, all converted into dollars, or you can look at it by controlling for inflation, by looking at them in constant prices. So I did that, but I also looked at a measure where it accounts for the cost of living in different countries as well. And that sort of, if you then look at the per student spend, which is obviously could be affected by student numbers, right? So you could be, the government could be spending the same amount each year on higher education, but if there are more students coming in, then you know you're spending less per student. So I think it's quite an interesting way to look at it, because it kind of allows the fluctuations in student numbers and shows you whether a country is able to invest properly in sort of the amount of money each student is effectively getting from the government for higher education. And yeah, that showed a really interesting sort of picture across different countries.
Okay, so let's talk about the picture that emerged once you'd looked at the data.
Yeah.
And maybe focus on a few examples.
Yeah.
So you talked in your article about countries where expenditure on higher education really took a hit.
Yeah.
So can you perhaps talk about a couple of countries where expenditure did suffer a lot?
Sort of by and large, most kind of developed systems, you would say, did sort of have seen a cut. And all the data only sort of goes up to really the middle of the last decade, or 2016, 2017, that they hadn't really recovered in terms of the amount the government was putting into HE per student. So some quite big sort of systems like France was still down. Spain fell by quite a lot. One of the most noticeable countries where there was sort of a big hit to the per student sort of investment in HE was Ireland, actually. And it has recovered, I think, since this latest data is available. But that was a country that for the first part of the decade, its system really suffered. And that's something that's been identified in other reports by other organisations, like the European University Association does a quite big report looking at how much public funding is going into HE. And the countries that kind of, by and large, that managed to kind of increase spending per student over the period were ones that were already very low. So they were developing systems that just that had a low sort of start, and they continued to kind of invest in the HE system. But it's coming from a completely different place. So Poland's an example of that. Brazil, Chile. By and large, most kind of developed systems, you can definitely see a trend where they really the amount of public money going into HE just kind of fell over those years, and it's not just a picture in say the UK where we've talked about it. It's across the world.
Okay, so there was definitely a trend globally of cuts to spending in HE.
Yeah, by and large, you can definitely sort of see that, really. There's a couple of exceptions to that, I guess, in terms of developed systems. Switzerland is a country that already invested, had a very high figure for the amount that was that's invested per student. It fell, but it's kind of not really very much. It's quite stable, really, over the period. And Sweden jumps out, a country that actually managed to increase its spending per student on HE despite the financial crash.
You highlighted Sweden actually in your analysis, because as you're saying, it was one that jumped out. So can you explain a bit more what happened in Sweden and why it's so different?
So I spoke to somebody from the Association of Swedish Higher Education Institutions. Their Secretary General, Marita Hilliges, and she was basically saying that there's a few factors here. One, the financial crash hit Sweden a bit earlier than other countries, so in terms of public taxpayer money, it managed to recover quicker. Another one is that it's some of these figures kind of reflect research spending as well. So there's a lot, they've managed to kind of really boost their research investment, so that will be reflected in the figures as well. One thing that she did point out is that might be that on that figure you're seeing a general increase, or that seem to have bucked the trend, that they have other issues that they're not kind of completely happy about. There's it's one of the most competitive funding systems in the world in terms of research funding, and they feel like the balance has gone too far there, and that they, even though there's a lot of money going in, they have to spend a hell of a lot of money to try and compete with each other, the universities, to get that research funding, and there's a lot of money wasted, and it's a bit inefficient, and that's the view of the universities anyway. The government might not say that's the same. So even where the figures kind of point to a country that seems to have invested still in terms of taxpayer funding despite the crash, there'll be other factors that you have to kind of think about as well. And of course, the big elephant in the room with this analysis is that we're looking at government spending. What the financial crash really caused when it came to HE was it caused a few countries to shift the method of how they finance higher education towards private investment, basically fees, for instance, the UK being a really big example there. And so they dealt with a financial hit to the amount of money coming into governments by looking at other ways of funding higher education.
Yeah, so that that actually brings me on to my next point. So looking at the UK or looking at so if we look at the UK or look at England in particular, how does all of this relate to the past decade's battle over tuition fees? This is something you talked about in your article.
Yeah, so that kind of leads on to that quite nicely. I didn't include figures for the UK here because it's quite difficult to tell whether, because we have a loan system in the UK, it's difficult to tell whether that's been accounted for in these figures. When they say government spending, do they mean the amount of money that they've loaned students? Are they just looking at the amount of money they expect to get back? It's not totally clear how they've sort of measured that here. That ties into the fees debate, because immediately after the recession, in the UK, the government decided it was going to cut public spending across the board. Universities arguably escaped a lot of that because that it was decided to put up fees to make up for the fact that they're going to have to cut public spending. So they came up with this system where, well, it was already a loan system, but where they continued to invest as much money on the face of it as they were before, but it was all being channeled through loans to students and high tuition fees. And the amount of money that kind of the government has to subsidise for that system is the key sort of aspect of whether when you're trying to assess how much the government's actually putting into HE in the UK. But it's an argument that not just applies to the UK, the US especially as well, because in the US there's a very interesting report that's done every year looking at state funding for higher education. So you're talking about the public universities, the public state systems, how much money comes from each individual state's sort of taxpayer funding into those universities. And over the last 10 years, there's been a quite obvious shift towards the state governments cut their funding. They had to put up tuition fees to compensate. But unlike the UK, they didn't have like a state backed loan system that kind of helped with that, really. Basically, you either can see in some countries there's a clear financial hit, or you can see that the nature of funding higher education was fundamentally altered to deal with the financial trouble.
Okay, it's really interesting how different countries have approached it. I know, as you said at the beginning, the figures that we've got are only going into sort of as far as 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
But in terms of today, what are your thoughts on how well HE has recovered from the financial crash now that we're, 12 years on?
I think it's still struggling to recover from it, if I'm honest. If you're looking at in a global picture, if you're looking at the developed systems that would have been hit by the crash most, and not those ones that are kind of that were already not investing so much, you could see that most countries are only just beginning to kind of bring their spending back up to the levels of the pre global financial crisis, or that they fundamentally altered their systems with arguably quite major changes to the way students access higher education. So in the UK, it's become a much more marketized system as a result of what happened. I think I'm not sure it will ever be the same again, actually, as before the crash, unless we have another major readjustment in terms of how higher education is funded around the world.
So that's something that I guess will be ongoing possibly for the next decade.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
On to another story, also from our 23rd January edition. So Simon, you reported that the UK sector is becoming increasingly reliant on student fees from Chinese students. So how big is this new dependency? Is it very new? What's going on there?
So it's kind of ties in quite nicely what we were just talking about how universities have had to try and find other ways to find income if they're struggling to get the money from government. So what's happened in the UK over the last 10 years is there's been a bit of a shift towards trying to recruit a lot more students from China. The reason for that is that around about 2012, 2013, I can't remember the exact year, but there was a major change in the government's policy towards student visas, and they scrapped something called the post-study work visa. And that deterred a lot of students from outside the European Union from wanting to come and study at UK universities, especially from countries like India.
Just to jump in and explain, so the post-study work visa, I believe was a two-year visa that graduate students could use to stay in the UK and work, it was a great incentive, obviously, for coming to the UK to study.
That's right,
And that, as Simon just said, that was scrapped in 2012.
Yeah, and because that was scrapped, there was a huge drop in demand from some countries, basically, as well as generally there was a kind of tightening on the numbers that the government wanted to see come in. But China, there wasn't. So that became the kind of country where Chinese students were more willing to come study here and go back home. And that became the country where there was huge demand from there and the obvious place to try and target your recruitment. And so what's happened over that period is China has basically underpinned the growth in non-EU student recruitment for UK universities. And it's got to a point sort of now where the sort of latest figures that were just brought out on enrolments, which were for 2018-2019, I think the one that jumped out at me the most was that a third, more than a third, 35% of all non-European Union students at UK universities are now from China. So, and at some, in particular, some universities, the figures are pretty astonishingly high. So, for instance, the University of Liverpool, almost a fifth or 17% of all their students, I'm talking about postgraduates, undergraduates, UK, wherever they're from, so almost a fifth of all their students are from China. And that, for Liverpool, that's a particular example. They have so there's a good reason for that because they have a shared campus in China with a Chinese university. And so they have schemes whereby students at that campus in China can come and study in Liverpool. So that would be an but they're not, they're by, although they're an extreme example, a lot of other universities that they have very high percentage of their non-EU students that come from the country.
And is it a particularly big jump for the universities like Liverpool, or there's you know, a few others you picked out, like the University of the Arts London, University of Sheffield, is this a really significant increase over a short space of time?
I wouldn't say it's suddenly happened. It's happened over the course of 10 years, really. But I think I looked at some figures for 2006 and how many Chinese students were at UK universities. And if you compare it with then, like, the rise is just astonishing. It's huge. I can't remember the figure off the top of my head. But and so I think at some of these universities, it's not just happened overnight. It's happened over a few years, but it's just drifted that way because of various, mainly because of immigration policy and that kind of push universities to recruit much more from China. And it was also a good market to go for because there's increasing middle class, more families with money that want to study in the West. So it's been a kind of a drift, but yeah, it depends what you call a short space of time, I suppose. I mean, in the general scheme of the world, you know, 10 years is pretty much overnight, I think, really, in terms of how this has happened. But yeah, it didn't happen in just 1 year.
Sure. And so, I mean, is this increase in Chinese students and this sort of becoming a bit more reliant on Chinese student fees, is it a problem for UK higher education, or is it going to be seen as something positive?
I mean, that's the big sort of question, isn't it? Is it a problem? I spoke to a researcher called Martin Garland, who's looked at the issue of financial diversification. So in other words, she looked at how universities kind of do they put all their eggs in one basket, basically, when it comes to the money that they get? To what extent do they say, okay, we'll get a little bit from research, a little bit from tuition fees, a little bit from kind of using our state in some way? Or do they kind of try and just go after one source of income? And she was telling me that there are sort of concerns out there about an over-reliance on China. I suppose maybe not so much financially, because the universities that recruit most heavily from China are the selective universities, the Russell Group, to a certain extent, and other research-intensive universities, and they have quite diverse income portfolios, really. They don't just rely on income from UK students or Chinese students. They do get a lot of money for their research as well. So if suddenly there was a change in the demand from China, they could adjust. But I think some of them were saying that kind of just in practical terms, or you know, what they're trying to project to the world as a kind of multinational sort of campus where you'll find students from every country, it potentially could be a problem. So, you know, if you get a student from another country in the world that wants to come and study at a UK university, and then they come here and they find they're in a they're on a course where all the other students are from China, and not even sort of from the UK, and that might happen on some postgraduate courses, then that could be, you know, a potentially a problem in terms of trying to attract people from different parts of the world. So I think that there certainly were concerns, but it might not be financial just yet. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think any reliance on one particular fees from one particular country is really open to a sudden global shift in, and when we're seeing it at the moment, you know, the trade war between the US and China has mm-hmm. completely changed the politics of the world, and you know, China's such a huge country, it could suddenly decide it's not going to allow so many students to go abroad, or you know, you could see sudden shifts in currency mm-hmm. Exchange rates, which affect kind of how cheap or expensive fees are relatively. Yeah, it just is a risk, I think.
Okay. And well, we saw, so last September 2019, the government made another announcement about the post-study work visas, which you mentioned earlier. So yeah. They've have said that they're going to reintroduce these post-study work visas. And since that happened, there's been an increase in applications from Indian students to study here, which is something else that you mentioned in your article. So do you think that was one of the government's aims, and that's going to maybe help the issue?
I don't know if it was necessarily done specifically because of the large number of Chinese students. I just think the sector universities in the UK have been lobbying the government for a long time to bring it back, mm-hmm. saying that it was deterring students from a lot of countries from wanting to come and study here, particularly India. And I think bringing it back will, I think, over time, diversify the countries where you see students come from a bit more. And I think universities probably want to do that as well. Mm-hmm. And I think India is the big country where you'll see that change, because it's, again, a massive, massive youth population, increasingly bigger middle class, people with more money to come and study abroad. I just think it's natural that if post-study work visas are kind of what attract those students to come to the UK, then yeah, you'll see maybe a more of a rebalancing towards seeing more students come from there and the subcontinent, more generally Sri Lanka, Pakistan, other countries as well.
Okay. Now the sort of concerns about being too reliant on Chinese fees is not a UK specific issue. It's something that is discussed a lot in the Australian HE sector and in the US as well. Is it very similar what's happening over there, or have they got an even a bigger percentage of Chinese students?
Yeah, so I mean, what I didn't talk about so far actually is that the whole premise of this was to try and work out the income reliance. Mm-hmm. So although you can't work that out exactly, because you need to know exactly what fees Chinese students are paying, you can kind of estimate it by looking at the share of Chinese students out of the total non-EU cohort of students. And then there are figures for the amount of money that universities in the UK get from non-EU students. So you can apply the same percentage almost and come up, and that's how I estimate it. And kind of the figures were that, you know, there were a few universities that were above 10% of all their income coming from Chinese students. But more, probably the threshold is more 5% to 10%. There were a lot of, you know, the universities, an increasing number. And then there were a few over 10%. If you compare that with Australia, John Ross did a piece for us last year where... he looked at some research that looked at estimated income reliance. They're more like a fifth. Some universities there, it's over 20% wow. of all their income is basically sort of coming from fees paid by Chinese students. So you would say that they're kind of more progressed towards it being an over-reliance there, and there's more of a debate there publicly, I think, about whether universities have kind of overexposed to that as a market. Mm-hmm. In the US, I'm not really sure that there's a big discussion about financial over-reliance on Chinese students. It's more a big debate about the politics of it. So yes. what's kind of happened there is there's been this increasing atmosphere of the Trump administration kind of viewing China with suspicion, and that's filtered down into research and universities, because there's been a lot of questions asked by the administration about Chinese researchers. Are they here with kind of legitimate intentions? You know, are they work? You know, are just basically a suggestion that some Chinese researchers are spying in some way, and that kind of culture of fear almost has then trickled down into kind of what all these students coming here for as well. And yeah, so it's more of a toxic kind of political debate over there, I think.
All right, so moving on to the final story we're gonna look at. This is a story this is something that's been going on in Indonesia. So recent figures are showing that there's been a huge increase in the publication of domestic research, and at the same time a drop in international collaborations.
Yeah.
Now some are attributing this towards a government policy which was introduced in 2017, which tied salary bonuses to the number of articles a scholar published either in Indonesia or internationally in journals. Can you perhaps start by explaining a bit about the figures? Are we talking really big increases and decreases?
So the reason this jumped out at me is that I'm often looking at measures of kind of research, research metrics, I guess, for different countries. And one of the measures of internationalization, which is often used, is how the share of a country's research that involves collaboration with other countries. And generally, this is just going up all the time. International collaboration in research is becoming more and more important and more interwoven. And there are countries like Switzerland where it's up to about 70% of all their research involves collaboration with other countries. And that's not a surprise given Switzerland's geographic position and it being a small country. But even countries like the US and China, which are bigger and have lower international shares of their research being featuring collaboration, are climbing all the time. So it jumped out at me that Indonesia, basically, their sort of share of international, their percentage of research that featured international collaboration has sort of dropped by about half, from 40% in 2014 to 17% in 2018, which is completely against the international trend elsewhere. Bit bizarre. Looked into it a bit more. And then you find that basically the amount of research Indonesia is producing has been increasing rapidly. But it's been increasing much more rapidly if you look at research that just involves kind of domestic, just researchers in one university or researchers between two Indonesian universities. That's where it shot up much more quickly. And then when you ask experts about it, you find that probably a good reason for this is this policy that was brought in, which there was essentially a bonus paid to professors and researchers of a certain rank anyway, and the government decided to tie this to their publication output, and it could be in international journals or in domestic journals. I think you had to publish less in international journals to qualify for this bonus. But because of the difficulty for some researchers in collaborating internationally, language barrier, the amount of money they might have, the contacts they have, more opted for the sort of domestic research way to earn this bonus and started publishing a lot more research, just collaborating with their people in their institution or in other universities in Indonesia. So the volume of that research has rocketed, and it's caused the share of research that comes internationally to sort of drop.
Okay, and I mean, is that going to be a big problem for higher education in Indonesia?
I mean, it could be because it's a really good example of where government policy can have these unintended consequences. If you start mucking around with incentives for researchers, you can suddenly change the research landscape massively. And it could be a problem if your country is trying to improve the quality of its research. And there's lots of evidence to show that quality is improved by working with researchers in different countries. If you're just publishing a lot of research, but it's only coming from your own country and it's not involving working with experts elsewhere, then there's an argument to say it's not going to be of a high standard to push the country's kind of research expertise in the right direction generally. So I don't know if it's the best way of doing things, but I mean the government might see it as a success by literally just improving the amount of research that's published, but is that research of a good standard or not? That's the issue.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for explaining all of that. So that's been really helpful. Always really good, I think, especially with data stories, to get a bit more background and really sort of get into what's going on behind the figures. So that's all we have time for on this podcast. So thanks very much, Simon.
No problem. Yeah, good to be here.
And thank you to all our THE listeners. We hope you enjoyed this data special. Please do check timeshighereducation.com for all of Simon's data articles and, of course, the weekly magazines too.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.